I think most of us are familiar with the story of the rich young ruler. If you want to look in Matthew chapter 19, that's where we're going to begin this morning. And, you know, the rich young ruler gets a bad rap for the final outcome of the story, obviously, as he turns away from Jesus. But there are a lot of commendable things about this young man, how from his youth he had devoted himself to religious things, and he had been meticulous about keeping the law of God, and how he was convinced there was something more to life and something he was missing, and he knew that Jesus was the answer to his question. And all of those are wonderful things, but the one thing we remember him for is that he turned away from Jesus because he could not accept the answer that Jesus gave to him. And so in Matthew chapter 19, verse 16, "Teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may obtain eternal life?" And he said to him, "Why are you asking me about what is good? There's only one who is good. But if you wish to enter into life, keep the commandments." And he said to him, "Which ones?" And Jesus said, "You shall not commit murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." And the young man said to him, "All these things I have kept. What am I still lacking?" And Jesus said to him, "If you wish to be complete, go and sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come, follow me." But when the young man heard this statement, he went away grieved, for he was one who owned much property. And we could look at the other gospel accounts as well. We realize that Jesus had great compassion for this young man. He looked upon him and loved him, even as God loves each one of us. And yet, the man turns away grieved because he has many possessions. Now, what kind of intrigues me about this story is I've kind of felt in the position sometimes of telling people what I understood the Bible to teach, and that God was making some pretty heavy demands of them. And when they found those demands difficult, I felt this kind of sense of wanting to, water it down a little bit. Or, I didn't mean to make that sound too harsh. Or let me put that another way that might make it sound a little bit better to you. I could picture myself trying to chase after this guy and say, "Now, wait a minute, we can talk about this." Jesus doesn't do that. This is not negotiable. There is this mutually exclusive choice that we are presented with, that we will either serve God or we serve Him not at all. And that's what Jesus was saying in the reading that we had from the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6. You cannot serve God and money. Well, you really can. That's what people think. We can serve God in some sense. We call it serving God, but it's not the service that God would have. We think we can have it both ways. And that's not unique to people living under the New Covenant. We remember back in the Old Testament times, in 2 Kings chapter 17, we find there that the text tells us in verse 33 that the people were serving the Lord, but also the gods of the land in which they dwelled. Well, they weren't really serving the Lord. They weren't serving Him faithfully and truly in keeping with what God had told them to do, but they thought they were serving the Lord. They were just also adding to it, kind of hedging their bets, covering their bases, worshiping some of these other deities just in case they had some power to control the weather or the rain, whatever. And that's what people think they can do today. I'll go to church. I'll be religious. I just want money too. And the problem is, it's really not about having money. I mean, one of the difficult things about preaching the story of the rich young ruler is that this is not Jesus' recommended course of action for every wealthy person he met. Zacchaeus, the evil tax gatherer, he's not told by Jesus, "Go give away all that you have." You find wealthy people elsewhere in the New Testament. Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and tells Timothy, as a preacher, what are you to teach those wealthy Christians to do with their money? And it wasn't give it all away. But this young man was told to give away all of his money. Why? Well, I think it's pretty obvious because that was his problem. That was an idol in his heart. And without giving that up, he wasn't really ready to serve the Lord fully and completely. Matter of fact, he wasn't really doing everything he'd convinced himself he was doing. You notice the last command that Jesus cites in verse 19 is, love your neighbor as yourself. And he said, well, I've been doing that. Really? If you loved your neighbor as much as you love yourself, wouldn't you share some of your money with him? Why do you keep your money for yourself? Because you love yourself. You love yourself more than you love your neighbor, so you keep your money for yourself rather than sharing it with your neighbor. So even this shows that his religious fervor was really more just a put-on. It was really more a display. It really did not have the heart and substance to it. And not surprisingly, that's why he knew deep down in his heart he was missing something. There had to be something more. But when Jesus told him that something more was to get rid of what he had, he couldn't accept that as the answer. And I don't know that this man went on to live a troubled life, that he just couldn't sleep at night and tossed and turned. And, you know, the next 20, 30, 40 years, however long he had to live, he was just purely miserable. He might have gone on and been happily just the richer, older ruler, you know, and just been even more of a success, the way the world would define that. But an utter failure when it comes to how the Lord defines success. Now, you knew in time we were going to come back to talking about, on our series of idolatry, about money. Because money, or the love of money more specifically, this covetousness, this materialism, is explicitly described to us in the New Testament as idolatry. In Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5, you remember Paul gives this kind of catalog of sins, and he mentions materialism or covetousness, which is the same thing as idolatry. And in the parallel passage in Ephesians 5, he says the same thing. And so we know that Paul was really doing the same thing that we're trying to do in this series of lessons, is update the problem of idolatry to get to see people to see that it's not about image worship in some physical form, but that idolatry can take several forms. And so last week we talked about sexual sins and how they manifest various forms of idolatry. And now we see monetary or material sins and how they manifest as forms of idolatry. Now we're looking at the works of the flesh from Galatians chapter 5. And one of the intriguing things about that list is it does not explicitly mention materialism or greed. And you think, man, of a catalog of all the sins, you'd think money would be one of the primary ones. And that's why some people believe that some of the things mentioned in there, the evil desires, this kind of envying, wanting things that other people have, that Paul may intend particularly to cover those areas of money, of wealth, that we tend to be envious about. Certainly the principle is there, even if the term covetousness or greed is not specifically used. And you remember when we started this series, we talked about three particular forms of idolatry that are all attempts to address some deep-seated fear that people have. And it seems that this fear can manifest itself in three ways, and throw three ways that people try to get some sense of security and protection from what they fear. And so there are those who are more interested in comfort. They don't want to rule the world. They don't want to be idolized by everybody. They just want to be comfortable. They don't want to lack anything. And so their interest is in possessions and in comforts. They just want to be happy in the circumstances of life they find themselves. They have enough. They're adequate, you know. Then there's that second person, and they may not care about having two pennies to rub together, but boy, they want to be liked by people. They want to be accepted. And so the connections they have with people is of more interest to them. And then finally, there are those that are interested in success as defined in our capabilities, our skills, our accomplishments, our conquest in life. And people envy us because we, by comparison with others, come out looking better or stronger or smarter, whatever it is. Well, the point we were making, of course, last week is that you know, sexual sins don't fall in just one of these categories. They can actually fall into all three of these categories. And the same thing is true of money. Now, obviously, money is related to the first category in that you have a person who doesn't want to suffer any kind of deprivation. We don't want to do without anything. I mean, I may not want as much money as Bill Gates has, but I don't want to be hungry. I don't want to be living on the street. I don't want to, you know, be without, you know, bath water, you know, or whatever. And so money, you see, is my protection against suffering any of those wants. I just need enough so that I will be comfortable and not lack things. And not just enough to get by, but I want to even have enough so I don't have to worry in the future that I might not have enough, right? That's how it usually goes. And so the Lord actually has taken care of me every day of my life, but I still have this nagging fear, but tomorrow I might not have enough. Next week, next year, am I going to have enough to feed my family? Am I going to have enough to keep a roof over my head? Well, what am I fearing more, you see? What is my idol that I'm really seeking in life? And for those that are more interested in people and the connections, being liked by people, this I think is typically where keeping up with the Joneses falls in. Not that we have to outdo the Joneses, but just keep up with them. We want to fit in. We want to be liked by people again. And who better to get along with than people in our same economic bracket, that kind of thing. And then finally, obviously, performance-based people, they see money as the one sure objective measuring stick that you have to define success. Look how much money I make, or look how much money I have, or to use that money to manipulate and control other people and give them a sense of power and pride. You know, that's how sin can manifest itself monetarily as well. Well, as we mentioned, there is this exclusive choice that we've been given by God. It's not negotiable. You cannot serve God truly and serve money. That doesn't stop us from trying. And so the one option we can have, of course, is to serve money. And what is it we're trying to find in money? Well, basically what we're trying to find is self-sufficiency. I want enough to get by. I want enough to take care of myself. I want enough to take care of myself and take care of my family. Again, I don't have to have all the money in the world. I don't have to be using my money to manipulate and move influence nations, anything like that. I just want to be self-sufficient. I don't want to have to go begging to somebody else for money. I don't want to have to, you know, answer to anyone else. So being self-sufficient. And to be self-satisfied. We seek that in money as well, to find just, again, some sense of, you know, accomplishment, that I have a good job and I have a good income and, you know, this gives me some sense of self-worth and so on, and even significance, that I'm really nobody if I don't have a good job or making a kind of money. I mean, it's the kind of thing when you're going back to your high school reunion, you know, do you go with some sense of shame and, you know, like I'm just a cab driver or whatever. I just bashed all cab drivers listening in on the recording. But whatever occupation we may think isn't as successful as brain surgeon, you know, or rocket scientist. But, you know, oh, if I was a brain surgeon, I could all go back to my, you know, high school reunion and hold my head up, you know, and, oh, I'm a, you know, got all these advanced degrees and make all this money and so on. Well, is that what it's about? Do we sense and feel as if that's what it's about? Are those the kind of things we worry about? Well, no sermon on money would be complete without Luke chapter 12, which is Jesus' rather insightful story about this rich fool. And one of the intriguing things about this story is that it begins in verse 13 of Luke chapter 12. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." You know, my brother is cheating me. My brother's not being fair. You know, something. I'm sure this man felt he was in the right. And, you know, unless there's just something about Jesus that made him think, you know, Jesus is a shady character. I bet I could get him on my side. You know, he's one of these kind of mafioso kind of guys that's going to go beat my brother up and get an inheritance out of him. No, that you don't get the impression that's what's going on. Oh, Jesus, he has a reputation for being righteous. Jesus is surely going to insist on what's fair and right being done. And so he appeals to Jesus for his case. And I expect that the last thing he would have imagined was that Jesus wouldn't side with him. I'm in the right here. My brother is in the wrong. And surely Jesus will say, yeah, well, we'll get that straightened out real quick. But Jesus said, who appointed me a judge or arbiter over you? Beware, be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. Your life cannot be reduced down to a portfolio or a catalog of your debts and your assets. Even when you have a lot, Bill Gates' life is not the sum total of all of his billions of dollars. He will stand before God on the day of judgment without a penny in his pocket, just as you will. There will not be a whit's difference between us when it comes to money. Money will have no bearing on it. And that's why Jesus says rich people cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. It's not that there cannot be Christians that have money and that are wealthy, but you do not enter the kingdom of heaven as a rich person. That doesn't enter into it. That has nothing to do with it. And if you see yourself defined by your wealth, you have excluded yourself from the kingdom of God, because the kingdom of God is made up of only those people who see themselves as poor. Poor in spirit, absolutely spiritually bankrupt, that I have nothing of any value as I stand before God. In fact, I am in the debit column because of my sin. And we are mourning over our sin and seeking forgiveness from God. We don't deserve it, but we cannot live without it. And so we beg for God that which we don't deserve. And He freely bestows it upon us. And so Jesus warns us here against greed, against defining our life in terms of our possessions. And He does so by telling this parable. The land of a certain rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? And he said, this is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. There's a lot of fascinating things in this parable. First of all, the man was rich to begin with. Jesus doesn't tell the parable. There was a certain poor man who, you know, scrimped and saved and worked hard and reaped a great harvest. And then he said, man, what am I going to do with all this harvest I got? He's already rich. And he's received this great abundance. And what should his first response have been but to fall on his knees and thank God? God, you sent the rain. You sent the sunshine. You made the seeds to germinate and produce and have given this great bounty. And Lord, I know you've done this for some great purpose. Not for me just to kind of lounge around and take it easy. And that person who focuses on God and God's intents and purposes and who is grateful, the story is going to have a completely different outcome. But here's the rich man. And he sees himself as a rich man. He's defined by his riches. And so when he has great productivity, of course, that is a testimony to what he has done. His accomplishments, his greatness, his status. And now, oh, woe is me. What am I going to do? This was like Joy had a great aunt, and one of her great complaints every month, she had 14 dividend checks she had to endorse from AT&T to deposit in the bank. Oh, what a great trauma that was to her. I just thought, I'll take that over for you, you know. A great sacrifice on my part, but I'd be willing to do that, you know. If that's your greatest problem in life, endorsing your dividend checks from your AT&T stock, you don't really have any problems financially. And so here, oh, what am I going to do? I don't have any place to store my... Well, I'm going to build bigger barns. And so he's got too much. And rather than saying, well, plainly, I've got plenty to share with other people. No, I've got to find a place to put it. I've got to hoard it up. And I'm going to take it easy the rest of my life. And he gives no thought to others. Just how he's going to party, how he's going to enjoy himself, to eat and drink. You get the impression, you know, now he can eat freely. You know, he's the kind of, I made so much money that I can spend as much as I want every day and I'll never exhaust it. You know, that kind of thing. But the problem is, his plan, many years to come. You've got enough goods laid up for many years to come. Well, the reality was, a long time ago, before he was rich, he had enough for the rest of his life. Because his life was going to end right away. He didn't need many goods for many years to come. He didn't have many months to come. He didn't have many weeks or many days or many hours. He was going to die this very night. Well, you see, the problem is, it is all about self. You see the number of times he says, I or me or my. It's all about self, and that's what it is. Idolatry is really about self. It is our placing ourselves in the place of God. It's all about my comfort. It's about my acceptability. It's about my significance and value. It's about, you know, my status. But the fact of the matter is that God wants us to find all of these things in Him. He wants us to be sufficient, but not self-sufficient. He wants us to have significance, but not to find significance in and of ourselves. He wants us to be satisfied, but not to find that satisfaction within ourselves. See, these are all descriptions of God. We find our sufficiency in God, our satisfaction in God, our significance in God. And the fact that we refuse to find these things in God, but look for them in self, means that we have committed the ultimate idolatry. And so whether it's because we want money for comfort or whether we want money for acceptability or we want money for power, it doesn't really matter. It's an idol. It is sinful. You know, we're not told particularly what this man had in mind. It may have again been complicated, been a combination of things. But he'd clearly made his choice and greed had consumed his life. And he really had no life. What did he have? If life does not consist of the abundance of your possessions, what does it consist of? What did this man have when he stands before God on the day of judgment? Well, he doesn't have very much at all. He has made himself rich in this world's goods, but he is poor toward God, not rich toward God. Well, that brings us to the second option. And of course, we know that the Bible would teach us that we ought to serve God and not money, that we cannot allow monetary things or other forms of material comfort to become an idol for us. And there are three kind of things I would recommend we keep in mind that might help us in wrestling with this, because we certainly live, as we noted last week about sexual sins, we live in a hyper-sexualized society. That's one of the prominent features of American culture. And so it's something we're going to have to wrestle against even more so than certain other sins. And the same thing is true of materialism. That's the other thing that we are hypersensitive to. Money and the things that money can do, the comfort money can buy, the power that it can wield, and so on. Well, because that is such a significant feature of our culture, we have to struggle against it. And if we just think we're impervious to this, that's probably one of the best signs that we're susceptible to it. You know, money is a problem. And I think we've all had that experience at one time or another where, you know, you go to the grocery store and it's like, you know, $50 for a little bag of food. And you're like, man, $50, that's nothing. You go to put gas in your car, put a tank of gas, $50 won't even cover it, you know. But you go to put $50 in the collection plate, oh, that's just so much money, you know. It's all a matter of perspective. It has nothing to do with the actual amount of money. And that's true when you go back and look in Bible times. Because really one of the intriguing things about the Bible is that for the vast majority of world history, most people have not been wealthy. you know, you have a few people that are wealthy, like the king, you know, the emperor, you know, and a few of those close to him. They have all of the money, and then you got a bunch of poor people. So why is the Bible still filled with all of this warnings about materialism and greed? You know, we live in an age where, you know, the American dream is much more accessible, at least used to be. And, you know, anybody can, you know, if they have the right idea and market it or whatever, work hard, save, you know, you can live well. You can make money. You can even be rich. But the problem is, it doesn't matter whether you have money or not. The desire to have money is the problem. And that's why you can have Christians that have money, but it doesn't mean anything to them. It's just a tool. It's just a blessing from God. They're going to use it to serve God, and they're going to serve Him the same as if they didn't have a penny. Then you got some poor person who doesn't have anything, but he is consumed by the desire to get rich. And he's just driven by the thought of money. Oh, if I just had money. Oh, I'd be happy if I just had a bigger house or a better car or nicer clothes or the right kind of job. And he may never realize any of those fantasies and desires, but he's still consumed by the idolatry of money. So it's not what you have, it's the attitude and the perspective that we have. And it is this attitude that makes $50 seem so much when it's given to some, well, voluntary thing. I mean, I have to put gas in my car because I need that to get around and go to work. You know, I've got to buy food. But I don't have to help that poor person. I don't have to, you know, put that money in the collection. You know, that perspective that sets in. Well, that's when you're evaluating everything according to money rather than the will of God. The demands of God's will are just as sure to help that poor person as to put gas in our car, or more so. But we don't see it that way if our perspective is skewed. And so what can we do to help us in struggling with this money? Well, first of all, of course, everything belongs to God. That's what the Bible tells us. The 24th Psalm, the earth is the Lord and everything that it contains. Well, just think of the significance of that. Everything belongs to God. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 15, as he came naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. That's the plight of all people. We entered into this world without a penny to our name, not any clothes, nothing. And we're going to leave the same way and stand before God the same way. Not a stitch of clothes, no money, no possessions, no nothing, no titles, no accomplishments, nothing that we can present before the Lord. And if we could just remember this, it would help us immensely. And so what do? You get up in the morning, and you get out of God's bed, and you go get God's toothbrush, and you brush God's teeth, and you put on God's clothes, and you go get in God's car, and you drive to God's workplace, and you work for God, and you come home to your family that is God's, and you eat God's food, and you see? And when you have that attitude and perspective, everything belongs to the Lord. If we could just really look at it that way, that would free us from this kind of slavery that we have toward our money. And so everything belongs to God. The second thing we need to remember is we belong to God. Again, in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, we'll look at a number of different verses here in this section that talk about money. I mean, you think again, what is it you worry about? Because that's really what defines you. What are your fears? What are you grasping for as some sense of security? So what do you find yourself worrying about? Now, let me ask you this. Do you find yourself worrying about how to pay your bills? Or about your job, this, that, and the other, things that have to do with money? Or do you worry more about Justin Savannah's upcoming child being born? Is that more on your mind? Well, that's just a simple kind of illustration. What ought we to be thinking about? You know, the fact of the matter is, you don't even have to look outside of yourself. You know, are you more bothered by needing to pay your bills, or the fact that you're not growing as you should spiritually, or bothered that you're not doing enough for the Lord. You know, those are the things that we ought to be bothered by. You know, we don't lose sleepless nights because of our money situation. We lose sleepless nights because of our sin situation. That's what bothers us. That's what's eating away at us. That's what worries us. Why am I not a better Christian? Why do I don't read my Bible more? Why am I not pray more? Why am I not doing more? Why aren't these the things that we worry about? Why aren't these the things that bother us? Oh, fretting about our bills and fretting about our income and fretting about our jobs and businesses. Well, it's natural, of course. It's hard to get away from it. That's how indoctrinated we are. But we ought to remember that we belong to the Lord. And part of that is to remember, you know, is the Lord really going to hang us out to dry, you know? The Lord just doesn't care about us that much. We're really just going to suffer that desperately. I mean, one of the greatest comforts I have is, I was talking about this with the boys the other day, I'm talking about homeless people. And so the one thing I'm confident of is I will never be homeless. Now, that doesn't mean I won't lose my house and be in poverty and all that, but I know so many Christians that if I'm going to be homeless, we're going to be homeless together at least, you know. I mean, I just have no fear that God's people are going to just leave me out on the street with my family with nothing. It isn't going to happen, because that's what God's people are. And more than that, that's who God is as our Father. We will not be found begging bread. We will not be found in such desperate circumstances that it seems as if God has abandoned us. We belong to the Lord. And that was the very point Jesus was making in the Sermon on the Mount. You know, you don't see those birds fretting about, oh, what am I going to do? I don't have anywhere to store all of my great produce. We'll tear down our little barns and build bigger. You know, I mean, that's the very analogy Jesus gave. They don't store up in barns like the rich fool did. But God takes care of them. God will take care of you. Do we really believe that? Everything belongs to the Lord, so it's not really ours anyway to use as a measuring stick. And we belong to the Lord, and we ought to take comfort that the Lord will care for us. Now notice in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 10, the wise man says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. If the main thing you're concerned about is money, here's one rule you can take to the bank, and that is you'll never have enough. You'll never be satisfied. There's always going to be a bigger rainy day that's going to come. Oh, if I just had this much. And then as soon as you get that much, it's like, well, now of course I could lose this, and so I need some more as a cushion. And it seems that the more you have, the bigger of cushion you feel like you need. The fact of the matter is, the more you have, the more you fear losing it. And that was obvious to me when I was in Ethiopia. And I found this out too late, but they told me later, said, now, whatever you do, don't compliment anybody about anything they have, because they'll give it to you. And I'd already done that. I'd already found that out. So that's a lovely thing. Here it is. It's like you only have two objects you own, and you just gave me half of them. And here in America, someone comes in my house and says, oh, what a lovely TV you have. Well, thank you. But the last thing I'm going to do is say, well, here, you take it. Have you ever known anybody to do that? Why is it that Americans who are so affluent, if anybody could afford to give stuff away like that, but it's because we do have that stuff, and we are too attached to it. And so the more we have, the more we're going to be dissatisfied, because our focus is on money. Now, is it true that a person can have a great abundance and not be fixated on it? Yes, he's free of that slavery to it. He's found the secret to being able to say, no, it's not my money. I'm not really rich. I'm just as poor as you are. None of us have a penny to our name, but the Lord has blessed me with the stewardship of this amount here, and I'm going to use it to serve Him. That's not a person who's dissatisfied with money. That's not a person who's thirsting for more and just got to have more. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? You know how this works. Person figures out how to live at a certain income level. I make $40,000 a year. it just seems that's exactly what I need to get by on. Then you get a $10,000 raise. Now I'm making $50,000 a year. And suddenly, I don't have $10,000 extra dollars at the end of the year. That got spent somewhere. I could make $100,000, and where would it be? You know, again, where does it end is the principle. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. You know, I remember hearing stories about J.D. Rockefeller, you know, couldn't sleep at night because he's fretting about his shipments, you know, whether they'd make it across the, you know, the Great Lakes or not. What difference does it make? You could lose shipment after shipment and not even feel the loss. But, you know, that's what happens when you're that attached to your money. And so you see all of these principles about money and the longing for money. And contrast that with verse 14. When those riches are lost through a bad investment and he had fathered a son, so then there's nothing to support him. In other words, okay, you got a son, and you've hoarded up all this money, but then you lost it. And what do you have to give to your son? What are you going to leave in your will to your son? And say, sorry, I invested in those, you know, Beanie Babies, and this is a bust, you know, they're not worth anything anymore. Sorry, son, that's all I have to give you. And the sad reality is that's all that some fathers have to leave their sons. But I think the implication of the wise man is, if you have invested in things that are spiritual, if you have laid up spiritual treasure, if you're rich toward God, you have something to leave your son, even if it cannot be documented financially. I doubt I'll have a lot of money to leave my children. And even if I did, by the time they divided it up, it wouldn't be much. But I hope I can leave them something of greater value to them than money. But what do you have if all you've had is money? If all you've done is hoard money, and you think that's what I'm going to leave them, and you don't even have that, what do they have at the end of your life but nothing? And then finally, we need to remember, of course, others belong to God. And this brings us right back to the rich young ruler at the beginning. One of the best ways that we can break the hold that money has over us is give it away. Just give it away. And prove to it, you have no hold over me. I am content. I'm not driven by the need for more. In fact, here, I'll give it away. If the rich fool had done that, he would not have been a fool. And he would have been rich toward God. And you remember that fellow that precipitated that whole story? Oh, make my brother do the right thing. Make him divide the inheritance fairly with me. What was he really saying? That the money that we're bickering over is more important to me than my relationship with my own flesh and blood brother. And you see Christians squabbling about stuff that's not nearly as important as the relationship they have and what they're willing to sacrifice and damage that relationship for some victory, some thing that they're fighting over. And so often that's the way money is as well. Well, I'll conclude by reading you a little story here. Hope you'll enjoy it. If you'd like to take your songbook and turn to number 197, we'll sing that here as a song of invitation. An American businessman was at the pier of a small coastal Mexican village when a small boat with just one fisherman docked. Inside the small boat were several large yellowfin tuna. The American complimented the Mexican on the quality of his fish and asked how long it took to catch them. The Mexican replied that it took only a little while. And the American then asked why he didn't stay out longer and catch more fish. And the Mexican said he had enough to support his family's immediate needs. And the American then asked, but what do you do with the rest of your time? And the Mexican fisherman said, I sleep late, fish a little, play with my children, take siesta with my wife Maria, stroll into the village each evening where I sip wine and play guitar with my amigos. I have a full and busy life, senor. And the American scoffed. I am a Wharton MBA, and I could help you. You should spend more time fishing and with the proceeds buy a bigger boat. And with the proceeds from the bigger boat, you could buy several boats. And eventually you would have a fleet of fishing boats. And instead of selling your catch to a middleman, you could sell directly to the processor. Eventually opening your own cannery, you could control the product, processing, and distribution. You would need to leave the small coastal fishing village and move to Mexico City, then L.A., and eventually New York City, where you will run your expanding enterprise. And the Mexican fisherman asked, "But Señor, how long will this all take?" To which the American replied, 15 or 20 years. "But what then, Señor?" The American laughed and said, "Well, that's the best part. When the time is right, you would announce an IPO and sell your company stock to the public and become very rich. You would make millions." "Millions, Señor? And then what?" "And then you could retire. Move to a small coastal fishing village where you could sleep late, fish a little, play with your kids, take siesta with your wife, stroll to the village in the evenings where you could sip wine and play guitar with your amigos." That sadly is the story of so many people's lives. We just can't be content with what we have now in the time that God has given to us. Let us be free of idolatry, and particularly the idolatry of money. If there's some way we can be of help to you this morning, we stand ready as God's people to help one another, to teach one another, to pray with one another. If you need to be baptized into Christ, whatever it is, if we can help you this morning, let us know while we stand and sing the song.